Brief History of Rome. The second talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought was presented by David Crabtree on October 5, 1987, for McKinsey Study Center's School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College.
The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Last time I mentioned these books, this time I thought I'd do a little show and tell and actually bring them. This is volume one of the Pelican series, The Early Church by Henry Chadwick. I don't know if I got that right last time. That's that one. And this is just the first volume of five volumes, I think. And this is the best of the five volumes, I think. This is Justo Gonzalez's A History of Christian Thought. And he has three volumes. And it's a pretty good series overall. I believe that this whole series and this whole series are up in the library. I'm not positive, but I think so. I know that at least the first three volumes of this series are upstairs. There are going to be five, only four are out at this point in time. This volume one, The Emergence of the Catholic Tradition, is excellent. Very, very good. It's a very perceptive. Now, for this week, talking about, I'm going to back up to the history of Greece a little bit and then go to the fall of Rome in the West. If you're interested in surveys of that, this is a pretty good survey. It's the Pelican History of Greece by Byrne. Cheap and easy to get. This is neither cheap nor easy to get. This is a history of Rome by Sinigan and Boak. I think this is out of print now, which is unfortunate because I think it's a pretty good survey. And before it went out of print, I think it went up to about $30. So expensive. The Pelican History of Greece. Sinigan and Boak. There is another book out by Grant. I think it's called A History of Rome. I don't like it nearly as well. But I took a course in this. We started out with this book, and then we changed over to Grant's book, Michael Grant's book, A History of Rome, and I didn't like it nearly as well, so I didn't switch. This is 6th edition. I don't know why it went out of print. And I'm not positive it went out of print, but I think it did. But you might be able to get it used. This used to be used as a textbook here regularly. Okay, I'm going to give a quick presentation of the history of Greece and Rome. Some of you may know most or all of this stuff. I don't mean to insult anyone's intelligence, but I'm sure that there are some who haven't gone through a survey this time period, and I would like to bring out some things that I think are significant for the history, for the development of Christian thought. I will be referring to this map. You probably will need your binoculars because we'll just be dealing with this area in here, but we'll still try it. We're a little short on visual aids around here. Okay, I'm going to start with talking about Greece. Greece started out, when it appears in history, it was a group of loosely organized tribes. And as we get down into written history times, it developed into city-states. Each city was a separate entity in itself, governmental unit. They were never able, throughout their history, to get united as a group. So it was always individual city-states. They were separate politically, separate governments, totally separate entities. However, they had a shared culture. They all were Greeks, and they had a common culture, a common understanding of who they were, a common religion. And apparently, the Greeks originally came, well, they don't know for sure where they came from, but it looks like they came from the northeast and then moved down into what is now Colchis. The two most notable city-states as time goes on are Athens and Sparta, and later Thebes. Now, Athens was significant from very early on. It wasn't the most significant city-state, but it was in existence and fairly significant from the first time that Greece appears in history. Sparta didn't develop into a significant place until later, when another group of Greeks came down from the north and settled in the island, in the Peloponnesus, and then it became a significant city-state. Then much later, the third major city-state is Thebes, and that's a ways down the line. But those are the three main city-states. They spend their time fighting each other and that sort of thing until about 490 BC. From 490 BC to 479 BC, Greece kind of enters into the world, in a sense. And the event is an expedition by the Persians coming from the east. Persia was at its height of power and was moving west. It went through what is now Turkey. It crossed the strait, Dardanelles or Bosporus or the Hellespont, whatever you want to call it, and then moved down through Greece to the south, towards Athens and Sparta. They did this on two different occasions. First was about 490, and the Greeks were able to repel them. Then the Persians ran into some difficulty passing the scepter from one king to another. They had problems of succession. Till several years later, in 479, Xerxes, another Persian. The Persians were still pretty much at the height of their power as a nation, but they had problems of succession. Kings dying and they didn't know who to replace them with. Or I guess it's better to say different people had different ideas as to who to replace them with. So it was internal problems until about the time of Xerxes. And then they got their act together again and made the voyage across the strait and moved down into Greece. The first time they came through, they crossed the strait and moved into Thrace. That Thrace is this northern part. And then moved down into Greece proper. But they were defeated and they were forced to retreat, and they retreated back over the Hellespont back into Turkey. There were Greeks living on the west coast of Turkey at the time also. That's called Ionia. One problem the Greeks always had was they didn't have enough good land to support their people, so they're constantly going elsewhere. And one of the first places they went was to the west coast of Turkey. It becomes known as Ionia. The Ionians were able to push just the Persians back during the time between these two conquests. In 479, the Persians came through again. They pretty much dominated Ionia again. They moved across the Hellespont. They went through Thrace, came down into Greece. They were headed for Athens, and they were not too far away, but they were engaged in a naval battle with Themistocles as the general for Athens. And Athens asked for Sparta's help, but Sparta was on holiday, so they didn't show up. And the Athenians defeated the Persian fleet very decisively, which put Persia in a position where they were forced to retreat. The problem in both of these expeditions, the problem was their supply lines got stretched so thin. They had enormous armies both times. And in order to keep that army in food and supplies, it was a very difficult problem logistically. They got their supply line stretched way out. And so when they were defeated and a lot of ships were destroyed, they were in real trouble, so they scooted back across the Hellespont. They left a small army in Greece, but the Greeks were able to chase it out without too much difficulty. So Greece was on the verge of disaster, but they were able to drive the Persians out. However, there were a couple of lasting consequences. One is a kind of patriotic fervor that developed. It wasn't enough to unite them as a people, but it did make them aware of their delicate position in the world and the need to defend their homeland. So both Sparta and Athens begin to take more seriously the matters, the affairs, political affairs of the countries all around them, and began to extend their So their spheres of influence begin to grow, both Athens and Sparta, especially Athens. The other significant effect is Greece is no longer isolated from the rest of the world. They've been exposed to the culture of the Persians, and that's going to make a big difference as time goes on. There are a lot of ideas that came along with the Persians that become incorporated in Greek thinking.
How long a period of time were these two excursions? How long did it take?
They were a couple of years each.
And was there any unification of the city-state armies, or did they all fight independently?
There was some unification, but it didn't last beyond the time of the wars. As soon as the wars were over, the alliances fell apart.
Now, isn't Sparta and Athens, what they kind of, they're always kind of opposing each other, and there's always that tension. Now, during this time, when they were trying to develop some solidarity with the other groups, did they become friends?
They did cooperate to a certain degree. When the threat was great, they cooperated to a certain degree and they fought together. But as soon as the threat was gone, then it was back to old patterns.
And how come Sparta didn't help them when the Persians were...
It was a religious holiday that day, and they couldn't fight.
So Athens understood.
Yeah, they were very understanding. But Sparta did help out in other respects, other times during that campaign to repulse them. Oh, they must have been good. Spartan culture was very conservative and very militaristic. It was not particularly imperialistic until much later. They learned that from Athens. But they were very militaristic and very conservative. And they raised their citizens to be defenders of their city-state. Right from their very early training, they were raised to be soldiers. Anything else? Okay, after the Persians pack up and go home, then it's back to their old tricks, fighting amongst themselves. However, Athens now develops a league of cities. At first, it's a cooperative effort. They all realize, this is with the Ionian states, which are in the islands on the west coast of what is now Turkey. At first, they do this because they realize that they need to band together in order to protect themselves against any future threats from the east. As time goes on, however, Athens takes advantage of the situation. Athens extends its jurisdiction, its sphere of influence, and does so somewhat forcibly. But it's at that time that Athens is at its height militarily. And especially on the seas. They controlled the seas. Some of the city-states then began to complain to Sparta and ask Sparta for help. And that's the beginning of the Peloponnesian Wars. At first, all the city-states realized they had to band together. But as time went on, Athens began to incorporate states that didn't want to be in on the alliance, as well as making demands on allies that were excessive and had not been agreed upon. So some of them complained to Sparta, which is the only other power in Greece at that time, and that begins the Peloponnesian Wars, which go on for almost 30 years. And those are, it goes back and forth between Sparta and Athens. And the end result is that those wars end up exhausting both Athens and Sparta. No one comes out a real clear victor. If anyone's a victor, it's probably Sparta. But neither one is decisively the victor, and both of them are exhausted, especially financially. Especially this island. Well, these islands, the Peloponnesian islands, are the ones that were inhabited by the Dorics, and the Spartans were Dorics. They were Greeks that moved down later and settled in on that island. Well, Persia is on the decline at this point in time. The imminent threat no longer exists, and so they just fight it out between themselves. But another threat grows. Oh, also, at the end of the Peloponnesian Wars in about 404, Sparta kind of has the upper hand, and so then they begin to demonstrate imperialistic tendencies and take advantage of the situation. So Thebes jumps in. So we have a three-way tag team match. Two gang up against the one that's winning at the time. So it becomes a real mess. They keep fighting it out, slugging it out, until about 338, when a new... After 404, it becomes a three-way contest. Thebes, Athens, and Sparta.
And that goes to 338?
That goes till about 338. And whoever's winning, the other two join up against the winning. Well, Athens, do you have a map there that you're looking at? Athens is right on the point. Uh-huh. Thebes is the northwest of there, not too far. It may not be on your map because Thebes is pretty much out of the picture by the New Testament times. In 338, their misery is ended when the Macedonians come down under the leadership of Philip. Macedonia is just north of Thrace. So Macedonia is like the southern part of Bulgaria on a modern map. It goes right down to the water. It's above. Here's Thrace. Oh, here they got it here, Macedonia. So the Macedonians come down and control virtually all of Greece.
In 338.
In 338. Well, somebody can look in here. I would guess that there would be a map in here that would show it. Okay, at this time, then, all of the city-states have been reduced to politically insignificance. Because now the Macedonians are the most powerful group, peoples, west of Turkey. However, Athens is still the cultural capital of the known world. Athens had established itself as the cultural center of the world, well, quite a bit before this time, probably in the 5th century BC, they were well established as the cultural capital of the world. And Athens served as a magnet for philosophers, playwriters, artists, architects, everything. They all flocked to Athens, largely because of the liberties that they enjoyed there, the freedom to do what they wanted to do, as well as the atmosphere that developed in Athens.
The Greek city-states are at this time politically insignificant?
Yes. By 338, they become politically insignificant and never to be revived.
Was Macedonia a nation, or was it a collection of city-states also?
Well, it had been united. It was a bunch of tribes, but it was united into a nation by, I don't know if Philip's father contributed to that or not, but by the time of Philip, certainly, it was a nation. But the influence of Athens was all over the known world and was spreading, especially in the areas that had contact with Greek culture. Even the Macedonians that come down, they were not Greek, and yet, by culture, they had adopted Athenian culture, basically. They spoke Greek. So most of the peoples in that surrounding area had adopted much of Greek culture, and especially Athens was the center.
The Macedonians?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if they used the term barbarians to refer to the Macedonians, because barbarians was usually used to refer to someone who didn't speak Greek. The Persians were called barbarians, which is kind of funny. They used the term barbarians to refer to the Persians, who they considered to be soft, bad fighters, etc., etc. Those are the characteristics of barbarians. Effeminate is another word that's used. But I'm not sure exactly what all the connotations of the word effeminate are in Greek. But I don't know if they called the Macedonians barbarians, because Macedonians spoke Greek. At least most of them did. During this time, philosophy takes root in Athens. And a lot of the great philosophical works were written, well, a lot of the thinking developed in the 400s and then was written down in the 300s. Plato wrote in the 300s. For instance, in Aristotle. And it's the beginnings of Western philosophical thought. However, please keep in mind that it's the beginnings of Western philosophical thought. Greece is somewhere in between the East and the West. When I first started looking at church history, it was puzzling to me when I ran across so many ideas that sounded Eastern, because Greece is largely influenced by the East. First of all, its position is close to the East. It's not as far west as Rome, and Rome has a different intellectual climate in Rome, as we see. The other thing is the influence from the Persians. When the Persians came through, philosophical ideas were brought. I mean, what am I saying? Eastern ideas?
Yeah.
I mean, ideas that we would connect with Hinduism and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. That to us, we would say those are very foreign to Christianity. But as we'll see, a lot of the early Christian speculative thought had Eastern ideas incorporated into it. And you say, where did those come from? Did those come from Jesus? Well, we'll talk about that, but I would argue that some of those came from the East. I don't know. Does anyone know when Hinduism got started and Buddhism? I think it's considerably, Hinduism at least, is considerably before this, is it not?
Sure.
But even if Buddhism and Hinduism had not started at this time,
the ideas
certainly were there. We can talk about that later when we talk about Augustine in particular, but my immediate response is that sounds a little strange to me that Augustine is markedly Eastern in thinking. But some of the earlier theologians, I would say, are. And the hallmarks of Greek philosophy are, one, it stressed rationalism. Knowledge comes by thinking things through very deliberately, methodically. And if you read any of the Greek philosophers, that's obvious that that's what they're doing. One of the spin-offs from that is that during the times of the philosophers, the Greek gods are in their twilight. The philosophers have basically disposed of the Greek gods. Now, part of that is a result of their exposure to the rest of the world. Because originally their gods were local gods. As their world expanded, they became less convinced that those local gods were of significance. There were other gods that they ran, there were other peoples that they ran into that claimed that there were other gods responsible for the affairs of man. Well, what I'm referring to is the intelligentsia. This is where things are at the level of the intelligentsia. At the level of popular culture, things are different all the way along. I don't know whether he was or not. But even among the intelligentsia, there was a tendency to not to do away with everything, but to figure out a way to rationalize the ancient gods, the traditional gods, and then add to it with the other gods. The mystery religions and the gods of the East. Hellenistic Greece begins at about this time. It begins with Alexander the Great, who was the son of Philip. Philip was the one who invaded in 338. Alexander the Great was his son. And Hellenistic times begin with Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great had been tutored by Aristotle. The Macedonians were thoroughly Hellenized, and they became exporters of Hellenistic culture, or Greek culture. Alexander the Great went east. He went through what is now Turkey, down through Palestine, into Egypt, played around there for a while, came up back through what is now Iraq and Iran, tried to dodge mines, went into Afghanistan, went into what is now the steppes of southern Russia, into what is now Afghanistan, Pakistan, even into Turkey, India, what is now India. So the extent of his conquests are phenomenal. Starting from Greece, it goes east all the way into parts of India, and as far north as the steppes of Russia. Just a phenomenal expanse of territory. And wherever he went, he set up these outposts, and he settled soldiers there. And they were Hellenized soldiers. They were either Greeks or Macedonians. So all over that region, we have outposts of Greek culture. Now, some of those conquests were rolled back in the farthest east, but in the other areas, Egypt, throughout Turkey, in a lot of what is now the Middle East, it was those outposts effectively Hellenized those areas. As a result, throughout all the Mediterranean region, they started speaking a language which was basically Greek, but it was a simplified form of Greek called Common Greek, or Koine. And that's what the New Testament's written. Well, after 338, Alexander died in 323 at the ripe old age of 31 or 32, I think. The Macedonians were Hellenized before they came down. They were already thoroughly Hellenized before they moved south and invaded the rest of Greece. And they became exporters of that. After Alexander the Great died, the world was split up into three parts. All his conquests were split up into three parts. In Egypt, one of his commanders, Ptolemy, set up a dynasty there. In Egypt, which was the wealthiest section. Pardon?
Who is that?
Ptolemy.
Oh, okay.
Ptolemy, so that's the beginning of the Ptolemaic dynasty. She was the last. Yes, she was the last time. This area, which is now the Middle East and Syria, Iraq, Iran, and part of what is now Turkey, was under the control of, I don't know what the name of the first guy was, but they're called the Seleucids. That they controlled what is now Palestine, Syria, Iraq, part of Iran, and Turkey. And the other one are the Macedonians. And the Macedonians. There continued to be another entity in Macedon. During this time, there was a revival of Greek culture. At some of these outposts, they became significant sources of Greek literature and learning. For instance, Antioch was one. On the island of Rhodes, there was a lot of activity. But probably the most significant is at Alexandria. At Alexandria, King Ptolemy, the something or other, I don't remember what number comes after it, he decided to build a library, a huge library, in which he would collect all of the great writings of the known world and some of the great minds of the Hellenistic world were librarians at that library during this time period. And it was at this time that he had the Old Testament translated from Hebrew into Greek. And that's what is called the Septuagint. And the abbreviation that you'll see is LXX, for 70. According to legend, there were 70 Jewish elders that translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek. And according to legend, they all translated it They all got together and they were all exactly the same. That was a legend that circulated among the Jewish community, and then later... Okay. Alexander's empire continues to kind of slowly disintegrate, kind of bust up, but it takes a while. In the meantime, Rome is on the rise. Rome started out as a small city-state. It grew through its own aggression. The history of Rome is very interesting because Rome continually defends itself into an enormous empire. Everything they do is a defensive act, but they defend themselves into a huge empire. It's kind of interesting. Well, I think the starting of Rome is given like 405. The date they usually give is 4 something or other, 407.
Well, I was just kind of wondering.
Except in Rome. Yeah, go with the 7, whatever you said.
753.
Yeah, 753. But there wasn't much expansion for a long time until we get to about the 400s. The Greeks, remember, had a tough time getting enough food because there wasn't much farmland in Greece. They were always going out. And I told you that they went to the west coast of Turkey. Another direction they went was, or east, they went west to the southern part of Italy and to Sicily, and they settled those areas. As a result, the Romans came in contact with the Greeks fairly early, and the Romans began to absorb some of Greek culture rather early because they were surrounded by Greek city-states, at least to the south of the Greek city-states. And as time goes on, they absorb more and more of the Greek culture. They add a different flavor to it. The Romans were by nature very conservative, both religiously and politically, and morally. They are also very pragmatic. So you'll see those elements removed from Greek thinking. And that's going to be significant later on, and I'll repeat that later. Rome had expanded its boundaries, it extended its control over most of Italy, and then it came into conflict with its first significant enemy, and that was Carthage. Carthage was here on the northern part of Africa, here, in what is now Libya, I think, Gaddafi's ancestors. Carthaginians were related to the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians lived just north of Palestine, in what is now Lebanon, and they were sea-going peoples, masters of the sea, and they moved one colony to Carthage and developed there quite a kingdom. Rome and Carthage collided, went into war. To make the story shorter, they had two extended wars. Well, the wars went from Carthage was finally destroyed in 146, and the wars began, I don't have the date, but at some time, 220, something like that, BC. Rome came close to being beaten by the Carthaginians, but the Carthaginians lacked manpower, and that's what Rome had lots of. And Rome was able to outlast them. If you've heard of Hannibal, he was a Carthaginian general who took his elephants and nobody else. But Rome was then called in to the affairs in Greece. The city-states were still squabbling. And Rome was called in by one of the city-states against one of the other city-states. Well, Rome came in and straightened things out, and eventually they took over. Whenever Rome helps somebody out, it's Rome's assumption that those people that they helped out owe them loyalty. And as a result, Greece came under the control of Rome. About this time that there was a change in government in Rome, it had been a republic, and it changes into a dictatorship. It's run by dictators. And that quickly changes, and it becomes a monarchy. And grows in power. Caesar, one of the dictators in the beginning of the monarchy, went north and conquered what is now France, and I think he even went into Britain very briefly, and he had to come back. Several accounts in Rome. His son, Octavian, who was later called Augustus, was from 27 BC to 14 AD, adopted son. He takes power and they extend their holdings even more. So the Roman Empire grows to the north eventually, taking in most of what is now Western Europe, including a large part of Great Britain, large parts of Spain, especially the east coast. It takes in northern Africa. They move east with time of Octavian, take what is now Turkey, Palestine, Egypt. So all around the Mediterranean and Eastern and Western Europe are all part of the Roman Empire. During this time, Greek ideas become more and more firmly implanted in Italy itself and in the Roman culture. The Greek philosophies, Stoicism, the Epicureans, those become popular in Rome itself. And the Eastern religions, which were attractive to the Greeks, become attractive to the Romans. So the Mithraic cult becomes popular. The cult of Isis from Egypt becomes popular. There's a period of chaos. Then in 68-69, then order is restored with Vespasian. And it's during the time of Vespasian that the Jews became troublesome in Palestine and Jerusalem was destroyed. That's when they destroyed the temple in 70 AD. Now, up until this time, there were Christians around. They were known to the government. But for the most part, any persecution of Christians was just local and not very long-lasting, not terribly severe for the most part. So, but persecution began to be a little bit more systematic by the end of the first century. And regulated from the top, ordered, commanded by the top, instead of local leaders. In this big expanse of territory controlled by the Romans, there is a split culturally and linguistically. In the East, they are primarily Latin. In the West, they are primarily Latin. They speak Latin for the most part, and their culture is, for the most part, Latin. Obviously, Latin culture was strongly influenced by Greek culture, but there is a distinction. Europe fits into that category. Latin was widely spoken in Western Europe. The Eastern part was Greek. They never did learn Latin. They continued to speak Greek, and the culture was more firmly Greek. And that's going to be significant. Start looking at some of the controversies that arose in the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And you can draw a line someplace down here. Northern Africa, Italy, and Western Europe all speak Latin, but from Greece east in the Roman Empire, they spoke Greek. Well, there were people, the intelligentsia in Rome, They knew Greek very well. But it never became the language of commerce or the language of business in the Western half. In the Eastern half, Latin never became the language of commerce or the language of business. But the intelligentsia knew Greek. The military is the only place in the East where Greek was used, or where Latin was used. But most of those soldiers ended up, during their time of stay, learning Greek. So any of those soldiers that stayed, and a lot of them did, in the East, adopted the Greek as their language, and they married women who spoke Greek. In about 250-ish, this is AD, 250-ish AD, the holdings begin to disintegrate in Northern Europe. The barbarians begin to make inroads into Rome's territory. And some persecutions develop, because back in Rome, they're saying that the reason that we are losing power is because there are Christians in our country that do not worship the traditional gods. So some of the most severe persecutions begin at this time, about 250 AD. The Roman Empire is beginning.
No, I mean, but who has...
Oh, Germanic tribes, Goths. Well, that was in reference to the Greek philosophers and in Greece.
So the Romans had their own set.
And the Romans are more conservative. Now, that's not to say that Rome or that Greek religion falls away completely, even in the East. Slowly it does, but in the popular culture, it remains much longer. Shortly after the persecutions, the territories are restored to the boundaries that they had been before the persecutions. And it's at that time that Constantine becomes the emperor of Rome. And Constantine becomes a Christian. And he sees Christianity as a uniting force in this empire with a great amount of ethnic diversity. One thing that was advantageous about Christianity, anyone could become a Christian. It was a religion that anyone could join up with. That worked well in an empire that had so much diversity. So Constantine embraced the church and tried to bring about unity in the church and church growth. And he was the one who brought the first church council because of the disunity that existed in the church, the council at Nicaea in 325. He ruled from 305 to 337.